So welcome. It is, what is it, August 2nd, and this is the summer nutrition counseling roundtable call where we just join in and in an unstructured kind of way, bring up concerns and questions and resources about nutrition counseling and how best to do it. We seem to have only two people on the call at this point. It was a little unusual. There may be some people who listen to the recording afterwards, so I'm going to give a bit of an introduction. And that is a bit about what I've been doing these days. I've been doing a lot of training. I actually did some training for some other dialysis folks. Here we have someone from DaVita on the call. I did some training for Fresenius and maybe doing some more for them. And I have two more motivational interviewing trainings scheduled for this fall that are open to anyone. One in Charleston, South Carolina on October 4th and 5th, and one in Philadelphia on October 25th and 26th, which is immediately before the convention starts in Philadelphia. And the location is very convenient for the convention. It's right just a couple blocks from the convention center. I'm working on scheduling more workshops for next year. I'd love to do one in New York, by the way, Shoshona. And actually, I had spoken with someone at New York Presbyterian, I think, about possibly partnering with them or something, and I'm not sure what came of that, but I'd love to do one in New York. And I often do partner with either a hospital or a university or a DI program because it works well. They get to have some of their people come for free, and then they provide me the room. I'm also looking for a location in San Diego or LA or Seattle or the Bay Area for next year. Anyway, so this is a pretty freewheeling call. I don't know, Shoshana and Amanda, whether you've been on the these calls before, but you can just chime in and ask whatever questions you have or share any resources you might have, or what's really fun, if you happen to have any exciting things to share, for example, a particular motivational interviewing technique that you've been using recently and discovering how effective it is. Now, I just got a little beep on my phone, which could mean that my headset is running out of juice. So I think I'm going to instead use my phone.
Hear me okay?
Yes, we hear you.
Good. Okay, I'll use my speaker on my phone instead.
I would like to start with a question, if that's okay.
Sure. And this is
This is Shoshana.
Hi, Shoshana.
And I work as an outpatient in an outpatient clinic where we see a lot mm-hmm. of children and adolescents
mm-hmm.
at the clinic. So I know I've never been on a call before, but I've listened to many recordings, and I know the idea of how to fit in health at every size is a very important discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it hard with children and adolescents who are specifically coming and often coming with their parents, or coming from the doctor who told them you have to see the nutritionist because you're overweight, your BMI, and this is the message they're already getting. So that's what they come report to me. And sometimes I'm not sure how, or I'm asking, I guess, for help with the wording of how to reframe or refocus the conversation when they've already gotten this message from whether it's their doctor, often the doctor, and their parents.
And their parents. And
yeah.
And the whole culture. And
yeah.
Yeah. Right. Wow. Big question. So tell me, so far, how do you handle it? What do you do so far, if
so
anything?
So I often start by saying, you know, why don't you tell me what brings you here today? Because sometimes they actually have no idea. You know,
right.
They don't know why their appointment was scheduled. So just to get on the same page, I ask that. And then it could be, you know, the they will say, well, the doctor told me I'm fat, or the doctor told me my daughter is fat. The doctor said I need to lose pounds. Like, that's how they'll say it. So I try to say something of, sometimes I'll ask, would you like to see the BMI chart? Would you like me to explain it? And I'll explain that sometimes when you're in this area, maybe that you're at higher risk for certain diseases later on in life, and the doctor really is main concern, and your mother, parents' main concern, and I'm sure your main goal, is that you're healthy. And what we like to focus on here is healthy changes, really not focus much on weight, but on healthy changes.
Right. So you sort of say it out front. With
and then
in
younger kids, because when they're 4, 5, 6, and 7 and saying that to me, it's really I have that as well. So to them, I say, your job is to focus on, you know, exercising more and eating, focusing on eating, you know, fruits, vegetables, different healthy foods, and not. And your doctor's job will be to worry, to think about your weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shoshana, these all sound like great ideas. Mm-hmm. And they, a lot of these situations, they put you in a real deer in the headlights situation. And it can be tempting to go into sort of arguing or something. And I'm not hearing that in your voice, which is great because you know, of course, that arguing or saying, but, you know, kids should never be expected to lose weight, you know, doing the whole argument about their height catching up to their weight and things like that. It's just going to feel like arguing. And it's going to put them arguing on the other side, basically. So you, it sounds like you're doing really well in a lot of ways. Now, one of the things...
May I offer...
Sure.
I used to do outpatient counseling, and I would see a lot of pediatrics for obesity and high cholesterol and sometimes even pre-diabetes. And I too, always felt, as a dietitian, especially in this age group, like I wanted to be very body positive and very food positive. So sometimes I would try to change the conversation and really kind of and get the, you know, child to think about and their parents and ask them what, you know, kind of like what about your health is important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, and then, and sometimes weight wouldn't actually come up at all. Like the parents might say, "I would really like for some tips on how to introduce different types of vegetables," which kind of all goes hand in hand. But or it's, you know, she doesn't sleep, or constant, you know, some other issues might come up that are preventing some of those healthy lifestyle changes from happening.
Yeah, and Amanda, I'm hearing from both of you. I was about to congratulate Shoshana as well for beginning very open-ended questions, evoking from the family, the kid and the parents, what matters to them about health, about their bodies, things like that. Because you never know, there might be some really useful stuff in there. There might be a kid who wants to be more athletic or wants to be able to go to something, you know, a camp or something. So it really makes sense to do a bunch of open-ended stuff first. What I'll do is just toss a whole bunch of things out and we'll see where they go, Shoshana. One is the issue of who is in the room when you're talking with them? And if we look at it from a developmental perspective, it just doesn't make sense to have the kid in the room at all until at least age 8, 9, 10, something like that. And I actually asked Ellen Satter that question because as a family therapist, she thinks, you know, very much in terms of the family and how families interact and the development stages of kids. And she said, oh, certainly, I never have the kids in the room if they're younger than 8 or 9 or 10. And that's something that is tricky. Shauna, you're in a clinic.
Right.
The kid's there, right?
Yeah, they have to be there.
It's his or her medical visit, right? So this, you know, this is a little tricky. It depends on what kind of flexibility and leverage and whatever you have. My suggestion is to see whether, at least in some cases, when they're younger than that, you can begin in a very open-ended way, the way you very appropriately do with the whole family, and then ask to meet with the parents separately for a little while. Because another way to look at it is that this is about behavior change, right? So who's supposed to be changing their behavior? And when you look at Ellen Satter's division of responsibility, it's the parents with young children. As they get a little older, yeah, they do have more choices. The kids have a little more control, and working with them on more fruits and vegetables, et cetera, is certainly can be a good idea. When they're younger, though, kids don't make changes that way by talking about it. You know, and that basically MI doesn't work, doesn't make sense with kids. So that it makes sense to figure out a way to be working with the parents and basically empowering the parents, helping them see that they have a very important role in the health of their child and that there are things that they can do. I apologize, I'm eating a cracker. I forgot to get a snack. Now, I've blathered on about this for a minute. Let me ask your response to this, Shoshana.
Well, my thoughts are on that?
Yeah, like the idea of attempting to work just with parents, with the younger one, at least.
Yeah, so just the way that it's hard because the clinic, they need to be in this space, but what I could do is I print out, like, fun pictures for them,
mm-hmm.
so they could just color on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just not really going. They're on the side coloring in the parents.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and make it clear that you'd like to chat with their parents and it's going to be boring, so, you know, give them something to color with or play. Absolutely. It's ideal if they're not in the room because then it's, you know, it's a little easier. And I'm presuming with some parents you also are doing a little bit of education about the division of responsibility.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
I do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you think of health at every size from a kid's pediatric perspective, the division of responsibility is certainly a big part of it. And then what you're doing is working on the parents changing their behavior about what they bring home from the market, what kind of snacks they put out, how often, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm hearing
health at every mm-hmm. size for a teenager.
Oh, teenagers. Yeah. And the tweens, which is even harder in a sense, because if you're talking like the 10, 11, 12, 13, you know, 14, that kind of age, developmentally, you're dealing with someone who can talk as if they can take in education and make changes the way an adult can, and they can only very minimally do that. They're really not able to yet, but they talk a good game, which makes it really hard, and then they can end up feeling like a failure later. And you're also at an age where the parents still do have, you know, a fair amount of influence, and, you know, they're the ones, presumably, that do the food shopping and things like that. When I used to work, I don't anymore with that age group, I would always sort of switch around in terms of who was in the room, particularly with the ones like 12, 13, 14, I would actually meet with them by themselves for just a bit, because I'd often find out things about what the parents do that aren't very helpful. Frankly, whether it's nagging or saying, you know, or grabbing food away or that kind of thing, or whether it's, you know, not purchasing the types of foods that are going to work well, and then have meeting with them all together. As you're getting up into the 16, 17, 18, they may be able to, you know, discuss in a classic MI sort of way about what their goals are and coming up with a plan and how they're making it a SMART goal, et cetera. They're only fairly good at following it through probably, but they might be able to. The problem is it's often really hard for them to get their brains around that health at every size idea.
Yeah.
And I suspect that's what you're bumping up against.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I just want to lose weight before the prom.
Right.
You know, it just very, they're very concrete still.
One thing out with teenagers, when I was at an outpatient facility, I would meet with the parents and the teenager in the initial appointment. And then in some follow-ups, I would just meet with the teenager by themselves. At that point, I think I had enough rapport with the parents with what they felt comfortable with that. But then it helped me build more rapport with, you know, the teenager. And then, like you said, you might learn some more stuff about some barriers that don't come up when the parent's in the room.
Right. And then you could choose, if you have the wonderful luxury of working with them ongoing, you can say, next time, let's ask your mom to come in for just a little bit for part of the session. And then you can basically referee the conversation about whatever it is, informing them that nagging doesn't work, or asking them to have certain foods in the house and, you know, that kind of thing. Thinking of the division of responsibility, even all the way through the teen years, where the teen is beginning, of course, to take on more of the somewhat parental roles, but parents still have somewhat of a responsibility. Keeping the division of responsibility in mind all the way through in all the different age groups can be helpful. And of course, don't assume that parents have a clue about it. I have yet to have a parent that I describe it to and they don't go, oh, right, oh, okay, you know, but they haven't heard it before. It isn't intuitive to them. I feel like we're sort of wandering around, Shoshana. How are we doing with your question?
I think I still am having trouble understanding the language to use, especially with teenagers who say, but I've been trying for a month, or I've been trying for 6 weeks. I go to the gym, I eat 3 meals, I don't snack, I stop the soda, and I'm not losing weight, so there's no point. You know, so that is hard, I find, to find the language to respond to that.
Yeah. What would you say if it was an adult?
I work mostly with kids.
Yeah, you just work with kids, yeah.
Well, I work with kids, but... I think that they have an easier... I work a little bit with adults, and again, I just find that they are able to understand the overall health message versus I just need to lose weight now. And if I don't lose weight, I'm not going to do this.
Right, right. And you're absolutely right that most teens... Well, we're all aware of that teenagers think they're immortal. And also, they really haven't gotten it yet that things they do now will affect their health and well-being later. They may cognitively sort of get it, but they really, you know, they can't put that together. And they also haven't had very much life experience of being on diets and then going off them and eating everything in sight and, you know, noticing what the deprivation of the diet does to them. You know, they haven't had enough experience about that.
Right, that's an excellent point.
And you can probably talk to your boo in the face about the fact that they're, it's because they're a teenager, they don't understand this stuff.
Right.
And they're not gonna want to hear that. Right? They're just not gonna. It's not getting anywhere. So what would you say? Well, I certainly would first do a bunch of reflecting back what I'm hearing, probably with a teeny bit of a reframe. I'd sort of say, so you've been taking this eating healthier really seriously. Now, notice, Shoshana, that I said eating healthier.
Right.
Now, that may be not quite the teen's perspective. You know, it may be that they're thinking they're just going to be on a diet to lose weight. You're slipping in that language, right? So I hear you've been working on eating healthier and getting to the gym more in the last month or two. And the results that you'd like to see is that number on the scale going down. And you don't see that, and therefore you're discouraged. I got that. You know, you sort of feed back to them where they're at. If there's any, you know, education or information you could give them that might be useful, I mean, for instance, things like, if they're doing any weight training or even if it's just some cardio at the gym, their muscles are going to start weighing several more pounds if they had been pretty sedentary before that, so that it doesn't mean they haven't lost or haven't begun to change their body composition. You know, you can do a little educating about that. Do you think some teens might benefit from that kind of education?
Possibly, but I think they think that's just an excuse.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they also may not know and also might not care that everyone else their age is still gaining weight. And if they're not gaining weight, that means their body composition is changing because they're still growing in a certain sense. That's all relatively subtle, though, and they probably, you know, won't see it. They just want to weigh 50 pounds less or whatever it is.
What about, do you think they would be responsive if you asked them maybe what are some other benefits they've experienced since they started
mm-hmm.
making all those great changes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, focusing in, you know, if you say, okay, so what you've been doing is you've gone to the gym and you've been eating, you know, more salads or whatever. So just for a moment, setting aside the number on the scale, how is it eating that way and going to the gym? What's that like? Or, you know, really open-ended, hopefully you'll get some positive stuff. Their GI system may work better. They may sleep better because of the exercise. They may have met some interesting kids at the gym. I don't know. You might get something in terms of outcomes. And it, just like adults, and even more than adults probably, it's going to be tricky for them to focus on those outcomes they may be getting. But give it a try anyway. You're certainly, it's worth it.
Okay, I appreciate that. Those were good ideas.
Uh-huh. Now,
people say that it's very tricky with teens.
Oh, it is very tricky with teens. And frankly, that's one of the reasons I don't work with them anymore. they're very, very frustrating. And they're lovely and have so much energy and spunk, too. Now, there's also, of course, looking out for any underlying potential for an eating disorder, which you want to watch out for. And I'm assuming you occasionally run into that, someone who's beginning to really restrict very drastically. What was that?
I said I would say more than occasionally. And it's a hard balance, you know, the two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially if they, you know, just are eating 600 or 800 calories a day and the scale's going down and they're still have a high BMI.
Right.
Those are really tricky. Yeah. And the little piece of education you can do there is about how when their calories go that low, their metabolism slows down, so they're defeating purpose to a certain extent. And that if they want to really weigh less in the long run, it's going to make sense to do it much more slowly. And, of course, if they're restricting that much, quickly check with them about their energy, their ability to focus at school. If it's been going on long enough, of course, get them checked out for orthostasis and all that and heart rate. But it sounds like more often what you have is the kids who maybe go on a drastic diet briefly, but they can't do it very long. Some kids I find are willing to review the limited experience they've had so far with diets. And if they've done some that lasted only a few days or a few weeks and they couldn't keep doing it, you could point that out to them and say, well, are you ready to figure out a more long-term way to do it, a way that's actually sustainable? See if you can get buy-in on that.
That's a good suggestion as well. I think these are all good ideas.
Okay. I wish I had magic for you. Generally, you already do open-ended questions to evoke things. I would keep doing reflections, particularly reflections anytime you can figure out how to do a reframe. Reframing what they're saying with sort of a haze perspective. By the way, do you have Dawn Clifford's book, Motivational Interviewing in Nutrition and Fitness?
No.
Very good book. And she has a very haze approach, so that's sort of woven in there. And then there's the other Ellen Glovsky's book. I don't have a copy right in front of me. It's Wellness Not Weight, which is primarily adult-oriented. However, the sections where both Ellen and I, in our various chapters in that book, we have a lot of wording, dialogues and things for working with the Health at Every Size approach. So that might be useful as well. Ellen Glovsky. Look her up.
Yeah, I got it. Thank you so much.
Sure. If I think of other ideas or other tips that I've written that may fit for this, I'll post them when I post the recording. Really, really good question, and not one with an easy answer. Amanda, do you have? It is Amanda, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, Amanda, working for Davita. Do you have any questions, concerns, input?
Yeah, so I worked in outpatient counseling, and because of that, I feel like most of the patients I saw were already at least in a contemplative stage of change, and I never really had discord because the patients wanted to be there. However, in dialysis, and you probably have had, you know, some people bring up examples of this when you were doing some Fresenius stuff, I've got one patient that I cannot get past discord with. And I'm really like, I don't engage in the conflict with him, but I don't know how to move the conversation away from that to a more constructive place.
Well, one of the things, of course, what you're dealing with dialysis, they're literally captive the captive audience. The issue of choice and autonomy is a real problem, a real issue, because they don't have much of a choice. They really do have to be on dialysis. So it's not at all unusual for them to find other ways to exert a little bit of choice, like not wanting to talk to the dietitian,
right?
Basically, and not wanting to go over those phosphorus labs, you know. One of the suggestions I have for you, and I hope it, when I say this, I always worry that I'm going to be sounding dismissive of the patient, and I don't mean to do that. But in a sense, it can be useful to think to yourself, what have I got to lose? This guy's not talking to me anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let me see how far I can back up and work on engaging with him with no expectation that I will ever be able to pull out the labs or mention phosphorus or talk about food at all. Literally just get on his page. Be there with him, chat with him, tell jokes, talk about sports teams, I don't know, anything, right?
Yeah.
And it's a situation where you have to back way, way up. I mean, when someone shows a little resistance, you back up a little bit, but when there's a lot, back way, 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 way up. And if at this point you haven't been getting anywhere anyway with what you're supposed to be doing with him, you could try that, and then you may hear something that is a little bit of change talk, a teeny bit of something that then you could gently see if you could get an opening with. And obviously, if you get discord again, you step back. How does that sound?
No, that's kind of what I've been trying to do with him is.
Mm-hmm.
Make our conversations non-nutrition related, which works out fine. And we have, when we do that, we have a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably know that every now and then there's kind of a dire outlier that you have to address.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out ways to make that less painful for both of us.
Yeah.
But well, I definitely, the advice you're giving is definitely what I'm trying to do with him, just
mm-hmm.
to build kind of like that more friendly rapport, and maybe eventually, like, I'll get to a place where he thinks I can be helpful. But I think the problem right now is he just truly feels that anything I do or anything someone else is capable of doing to help him isn't enough to really help him.
If that's what you're hearing, I reflect that back.
Okay.
Literally. I mean, it may be really hard to do that because it seems like such a downer. But if you're sort of getting that sense that he's feeling hopeless, or that we're not able to help you here, or that kind of thing, that would be a fairly extreme rolling with resistance.
Oh.
But again, what do you have to lose?
Yeah.
Right? The more you can pinpoint what it is he's feeling that is causing him to feel so stuck and so unwilling to talk, and say it out loud, it may soften it a bit. And I don't know whether he's someone you can joke with. Is he at all a joker, or is there any sort of humor in your conversations, or
no,
not really?
No, he's pretty serious, yeah. He's
mm-hmm.
got, there's one person in the clinic that he has a jovial relationship with, but he's
mm-hmm.
that's the only person that he's like that with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because often you can,
I'm looking for this tip that I wrote on what I call tough conversations. Now I can't find it. I'm going to find it. That there can be some use for humor, like, boy, I'm the last person you wanted to see, or talking about your lapse is, you know, what puts you in a bad mood, or, you know, sort of in a somewhat jovial way doing it. Now, I am going to look for, I know where I don't find it. Hang on. I have my tips in alphabetical order here. Because there are techniques, how to bring up tough stuff is what I call it. Tip number 81, which is in volume 3. People in MI have developed have developed sort of formats that can be helpful in certain situations, and this is one of them. Since we have a minute, I will go over this, tip number 81. And if somebody doesn't have volume 3 of the practice workbook and would like me to email them out this particular chapter, I'd be willing to do it. So basically, the format to do is to, once you're, you know, chatting with them or whatever, first bring up the topic and ask permission to talk about it. And that could sound like, you know, Mr. Jones, it's that lab time again. Might we talk about it? And then sort of look at your watch and say, can you give me 5 minutes? You know, can we talk about it for 5 minutes? Then we'll get back to other stuff. Basically, ask his permission in a finite kind of way.
Okay.
To talk about it. And hopefully he'll let you at that point if you've been friendly enough. And then, as short and sweet as you can get, state what's true. Your phosphorus level was this last week, and previously it had been that, you know, or whatever.
Okay.
You know, whatever the facts are. And doing them, of course, I can hear already, Amanda, that you're good at the languaging, the neutral language, not saying this is bad or, you know, not putting a negative spin on it, just saying the facts. So this is what the phosphorus level was. And then there's sort of a three-step process. You don't have to write this down now because I'll send you the tip if you want me to. First is an attention getter, basically. I have an example here that's having to do with hemoglobin A1C, so I'll just read that one. This test here shows that over the last month, damage has been happening to small blood vessels in the eyes and the kidneys. Right, so that's attention getter about hemoglobin A1C of 10, you know. And you could probably have one phosphorus levels that are above whatever mean that there's, I never worked in dialysis, there's calcium buildup in organs, is that what it is?
Well,
it
forms like the calcium phosphorus product is what can accelerate like micro and macrovascular disease.
Right. And so what you do is you find a short and sweet way of saying that. If he knows it already, you know, then you can shorten it and say, yeah, this shows us that for the last several weeks, there is progression of that buildup in your, you know, in your blood vessels or whatever it is. So that's the sort of the factoid. And then the third one can be particularly important, and that is somehow offering hope or instilling some sort of confidence. And I'll just read the example from the A1C. People who cut back even a little on certain foods and lose even just 10 or 15 pounds see a significant reduction in this particular lab value and have much better chance of not developing complications.
right? So what could you say about, what about people whose phosphorus levels stays below?
Okay, I could say
And what can you tell about binders?
What can I say about binders?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Would be urging him to do to take the binders?
Yeah, I could say many patients in this clinic have been able to control their phosphorus by taking their binders consistently.
Right.
Or I could say, you know, having a phosphorus less than 5.5 is consistent with lower mortality risk in dialysis.
Right. And you would word that in the way, if you've gotten to know him a little bit, you'd word it in the way that you think would fit for him.
Okay.
If he's thinking nothing you guys are going to do or say is going to help me at all, he's probably also thinking nothing that he does will do any good.
Yeah, he has said that.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you say, you could even make up a story. You could make up, you know, there was this guy a few months ago. Well, you better not say that. Maybe he knows who it was. Anyway, but you could sort of say, we have people who come in with phosphorus levels exactly like this. They take their binders consistently for a month, and wow, their phosphorus goes way down. And they realize it wasn't as hard as they thought it was, for example, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
There are other people who want more of the scientific, you know, perspective or whatever, or the outcomes in terms of life expectancy, that kind of thing. Some people want it a little bit more concrete and hope-inspiring. And then the final step in all this is to elicit a response, you know, just something like, so what's your response to this, if he doesn't jump in already? Or what are your thoughts about this? Or how do you feel about what I've just said? Something like that.
Okay.
And notice that the shorter and sweeter you can keep it, the more you'll keep his attention. And the there isn't as much time for him to go into the yes buts in his head.
Right.
And if partway through you notice eyes rolling or, you know, yes buts sort of in his head or, you know, something like that, stop and say, you know, I hear you. You're feeling this isn't worth it. And then back up to the asking permission again, asking permission to, and you can see how important the asking permission is, because you're asking to open up 5 minutes just to have an open mind, you know, for him to just listen to you for a bit. And that might get something in there. And then if he responds a little bit with a teeny bit of change talk about the binders and when he could take them or whatever, then maybe you'd be off and rolling with a little bit of something.
I think that's actually really good advice. Like that's one thing I think I've forgotten to do with him is ask for permission versus just coming up and just starting talking to him. So I think I'll try that moving forward to see if that just kind of softens him up a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
You can both ask permission to, is this the time that we can come and chat, you know, be watching something that's important on CNN or whatever.
Right.
And then chat a little and then ask permission to go into the nutrition stuff.
Okay.
Do a more explicit shifting of gears and asking his permission, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when the call's over, email me to remind me, and I'll send you that. Do you have volume 3 of my practice workbook?
I don't. No, this is my first call.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, email me, and I'll send you that tip. It's tip number 81. Okay, good. Well, you guys got a whole lot of time today because we usually have like 20, 30 people on the call. I suspect it's because it's a summer Friday. People are heading off. So, any other concerns, questions, things to toss in, or we could wind up?
I just wanted to make one comment that
sure.
I was thinking about. This is Shoshana again. I think this ties in, because I was thinking a lot about the previous question I asked about the teenager, and then the teenagers that are starting to restrict and then over-restrict,
mm-hmm.
and what do we do about them? And
right.
I had a patient recently. She was in her 80s, so she was an adult, and she came
mm-hmm.
because she gained her weight. And she didn't know why. She lost weight recently, and she just was, you know, had a whole workup. She couldn't figure anything out, so she said, I'm going to go see a nutritionist and see what can I add.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very pleasant, well-educated, thought-out woman, and we had
mm-hmm.
a nice discussion, and she was very amenable to the discussion. And then she said to me, so should I keep track of my calories? Should I log them? Should I count them? And I said, I don't think so. I just... You know, I want you to try these tips. I want you to try incorporating
mm-hmm.
more of the food or whatever we discussed.
Right.
I don't think it would be a good idea for you. It'll just make you crazy if every day you have to
mm-hmm.
log your calories. And she said to me, and I thought, I think this really ties back into
mm-hmm.
our teacher. She said, right. She said, because my goal of gaining weight is to be healthy, and I want to be healthy. So if I now, you know, become OCD about what I eat and every calorie I eat, then that's not healthy either, and I'm losing track of of the goal.
What a wonderful story.
Yeah, and I think that really now is a great thing for me to think about when I speak to the teenagers who are trying to become healthy, but then become extreme, and
right.
explain them what is the overall focus and goal.
Right, right. And if you're noticing they're doing some behaviors such as strictly counting calories or compulsive exercise or, you know, anything like that, you can do some evoking of how sustainable that feels and how sane it feels or not, you know, or how much. There's a classic question I ask every eating disorder client, and that is, what percentage of your waking hours are you thinking of calories and weight and food and exercise and all that? And of course, with someone actively in an eating disorder, it's 80 or 90%. And a normal person, it's what, 10, 15, maybe 20% if they're a foodie, you know. So with a teenager, you could sort of get at that question. Do they really want to ramp up to thinking about nothing but food in their bodies for, you know, 80-90%. Have they got anything else they'd like to be thinking about, you know, and filling their time with? Yeah. Oh, that's a lovely story about that older woman.
Yes, thank you.
And, you know, when someone has life experience, they can fairly quickly see what's going to make sense and what doesn't. And shows how the teenagers don't have that. Yeah. Oh, okay. Anything else? Well, this has been terribly fun. And Shoshana, actually, if you happened, I can't remember who it was at New York Presbyterian that I was talking to about the
manager. My friend.
Yeah.
I can connect you.
Yeah. See if there's a possibility of me coming up there. Basically, what I need is a room that holds up to 24 people and on a Friday and a Saturday, and you guys can send one or two people for no cost. So if you can arrange something like that, that'd be great. Okay. Well, have a good weekend, everybody.
Okay,
and,
thank you.
Thank
sure.
you so much for your time and your tips.
Yep, sure.
Thanks.
This has been fun. Take care.
Have a great weekend.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye.